91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This afternoon we consider what makes a satisfying, profound marriage. No, not with Cosmopolitan, Oprah, or Dr. Phil, but with a scholar who's tapped the true marital experts. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Cornell University Gerontology Professor Dr. Carl Pillemer has conducted an in-depth study of marriage comprised of 700 people averaging 43 years of married life. All the subjects were elderly, of course. Dr. Pillemer has compiled the study results in his book, 30 Lessons for Loving, Advice from the Wisest Americans on Love, Relationships, and Marriage. Do opposites attract? What about pesky in-laws or grating habits? Find out next on Topical Currents. And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Enjoying such beautiful weather here in South Florida. I understand our guest hasn't had such good luck.
No.
Well, this hour we discuss how and why long, successful marriages come about. Why do some marriages thrive decade after decade, while others head for divorce?
We'll speak with well-known gerontologist, Dr. Carl Pillemer. He's the founder of the Cornell Institute for Transitional Research on Aging. He launched an in-depth study of long-married elders, 700 of them, in fact, with an average of 43 years of matrimony.
And Dr. Pillemer has published 30 Lessons for Loving, Advice from the Wisest Americans on Love, Relationship, and Marriage. And he joins us from New York City. Welcome to you, Dr. Pillemer.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And you're right. You're a better place to be right now than we are. So enjoy it, all of you.
We do. Well, welcome. Before I ask you the first question, I'd like to involve our listeners. What makes for your great relationship or what doesn't? Do you ascribe to the notion of love till death do you part? Or would you just like some relationship guidance from our expert? Our number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio at WLRN.org. So, Dr. Pillemer, we'll get to all your lessons for loving, but my first question, given that currently we hear so much more about divorce than marital bliss, do you think that the generation that you interviewed, 65 years or older, was just more prone to stay together than subsequent generations?
You know, that answer is absolutely yes. There are some things in which they are quite different from younger Americans today, and in some ways, which I imagine that we'll get to, they're surprisingly similar. But there's no question that rates of marriage have gone down, and rates of divorce have gone up. And that's due to a number of reasons, although I will say that our views of it are somewhat skewed towards the negative. In fact, divorce rates have actually been stabilizing and for some groups are actually going down. So I think that we may have turned a corner on that score. But yes, I think there was a sense of folks in that generation that they were going to stay together for life, that marriage was a lifetime commitment, and that they were less likely to divorce than folks, say, you know, after the World War II generation.
In the years I've been doing this program, it's always been just a given that we say that 50% of all marriages end in divorce. You say that's a myth.
It is a myth, and here's why. And the reason why I think it's important, Richard, you know, to point out that myth is I think it makes young people excessively pessimistic about marriage. I think that they go into it thinking, well, I've got at least a 1 in 2 chance of getting divorced, so maybe this is only, for example, a starter marriage. And the answer is that, first of all, yes, the rates are now probably closer to 40%, and they have stabilized. But a very important point is it's extremely different in different subgroups of the population. So, for example, a person who has a college education and who waits until their late 20s to marry has more like an 80% chance of making it to the finish line and only a 20% chance of getting divorced. So there are subgroups for whom the outlook is much better. and for the general population, too, things seem to be getting better. And there are some reasons for that, but yeah, this notion that every marriage has a 1 in 2 chance is really a myth.
What about subsequent marriages, or second or third, fourth, fifth, sixth?
I know.
Speak for yourself.
Well, you know what they say about a remarriage is that it's the triumph of hope over experience, and there is a little bit of that. A second and later marriages do tend to be less stable, but as I found in the book, there are a lot of people who feel that they got their first marriage wrong and then had a spectacularly good experience in their second marriage. So for a lot of people, it can be a good experience, but it's true that a second marriage is statistically less stable than a first one.
I'd like you to tell us more about your methods of the Marriage Advice Project and, you know, how you conducted the research and found and chose your couples. And by the way, were they all heterosexual?
No, actually, we included long-term same-sex couples in the study. So we have a number of folks who were in same-sex partnerships, probably 30 or 40 maybe, or actually probably a few more out of the total. And we got a number of those in our general survey process, but we also worked with older groups of gays and lesbians. And I'll tell you one thing right off the bat. If I blinded the names and the genders of those couples, you wouldn't notice any difference in the overall lessons for loving whether the couple was gay or straight. The actual lessons are almost identical.
Interesting.
So that was an interesting aspect. But yes, in brief, and you know, I could go on forever as an academic social scientist, but I'll be brief, and if your listeners have questions, I use standard accepted social science methods, and that's one way that this book is different from other ones about marriage, which more often rely on just a small number of couples. I did a national survey, so people were called at random and then given a long interview, and it's very nice that older people have high response rates and are often glad to be interviewed. I also got nominations in another study of all from around the country from people who could recommend someone who they felt had wisdom to share about marriage. So all of those studies were the kind of things that I, as a sociologist, routinely do. What's different is that this book is written more like an advice book and more for a general audience. But the folks I interviewed are as diverse as America's elders, racially, economically, geographically, and it turns out in terms of sexual preference. Hmm.
Did you find that the elders were, for the most part, forthcoming when you questioned them? Did they not shy away from certain subjects like, you know, sexual relations?
You know, I half jokingly say that I've spent more time talking to very old people about sex over the last 4 years than anybody else I know. And it really is remarkable how open they were, and even people who you wouldn't expect to, and how articulate they were about all kinds of issues. So I was continually surprised at how open, honest, and really interesting the folks were. You know, we did these interviews in a way that I think works especially well, in that instead of asking people for their life stories, my goal was to ask them their advice. So not, for example, what did you do in World War II, but what did you learn from it? And the same was true of this marriage book. A lot of it was phrased around, if a younger person was asking your advice, what would you tell them? And for a lot of older people, that's a comfortable way to talk about themselves. It kind of brings back this time-honored use of older people as sages and advice givers, and they respond well to that and really do open up.
How about the old truism of opposites attract?
Now, what the elders would say, and from this, that was one of the strongest points of view, the elders would say that opposites attract in the movies, and opposites attract and make good partners in literature, and as a real-life partner in a marriage, they say not so much, unfortunately. And in this way, elder wisdom actually dovetails with our scientific research, namely that people who are more similar in personality, in background, in values, do tend to have longer and more stable marriages. And the elders are emphatic about that. They argue that really you should marry someone who is a lot like you. Hmm. And people of all stripes, you know, said that. But there's one key nuance there. They say some differences in interests or differences in background, you know, you can tolerate. What you can't tolerate are differences in core values, that your outlook on life and your values about money, about sex, about children have to align, or you're highly unlikely to stay together. And that was one of those points that was made just by about 100% of the 700 people we interviewed. Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a break. Before we go to that, though, and take some calls, again, if you'd like some advice from Dr. Pillemer about your relationship, or you want to tell us what makes your relationship great or not, our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. I was really surprised by your research findings that led to writing this book, that older people in their 70s and 80s and even beyond are actually happier than younger people. Tell us more about that.
Isn't that an amazing finding? And it's
yes.
actually gotten a lot of press recently. It's actually so so important that it's been given a name by social scientists, namely the paradox of happiness. And it's a good reason why we should listen to old people, and a fundamental part of this project. Older people, if you survey the general population on just about any measure of happiness, people 70 or over and over are happier than almost everybody. Actually, the only group that's about as happy is people in their early 20s. Hmm. As soon as people get into the responsibilities of middle age, having children, work, etc., their happiness goes down. And it's remarkable. Despite a burden of chronic disease and despite having accumulation of losses, older people tend to be much happier. That they tend to say that the last 5 or 10 years of their lives were the happiest years in their life. So that's what hit me. Is there something they know about, say, things like marriage that younger people don't, and about getting through adversity and living through hard times, that we could tap that source? But yeah, that's remarkable. There, it's really something people can look forward to, and a positive aspect of aging.
Yeah, that's good to
and
know.
And I just turned 60, so I'm especially concerned about this.
Right. Dr. Carl Pillemer is a professor of human development at Cornell University and a prolific author. He's written 30 Lessons for Loving, and we're going to take a short break, and we'll come back.
Minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and gerontologist Dr. Carl Pillemer. We're talking about his study of marriage, especially among elders. Doctor, we were just talking about people being happier in their marriage as they were older. I had Dr. Dan Gilbert on from Harvard, who wrote the book about happiness, and he said, especially once they're empty nesters, while a lot of people say, oh no, the kids are going, most couples do surprisingly better once they're empty nesters. Did you find that?
There is something in, I would say that one of the strongest findings in social science is something called the U-shaped curve of marital happiness. And you've hit the nail on the head. Marriages go along happily. The happiness drops at the birth of the first child and never entirely recovers until the last child has left home. So one good thing to look forward to in an odd way is the exit of your children from the home, because it certainly improves marital quality. Now, not, of course, that we don't love our children and get existential, you know, kind of value from them. But there is no question that couples tend to be happier both before and after the kids leave home. And, you know, I think really that's because what makes people less happy on a day-to-day basis, often not the big-ticket items, but the daily minor irritations and difficulties. And that, unfortunately, is what children do bring. So, yeah, that is a strong reason for older people's greater happiness. That and a reduction of work responsibility and the anxiety that comes around work, I think those characteristics of middle age begin to diminish as people get in their 60s and beyond and they become happier. Also, there is a developmental piece here that scientists have found that older people get better at regulating their emotions. So the highs are less high and the lows are less low. And as you get older, I think a lot of people recognize that in themselves.
I was thinking about it, you know, how it's a two-part question. How do you know if someone is right for you? And what about the idea of perfectionism? Do you think that people today are more looking for the perfect relationship where the elders were not?
That is a great question, and those two questions really do tie together. In terms of trying to find the right person, the elders gave a lot of highly specific tips, which I mention in the book, but in general, they have two main points. One is that you have to follow your heart. 100% of them say that this strong and profound feeling of being in love, almost an intuitive feeling of rightness, is critical, and they describe it in a remarkably the same way. But, and here's where I think an old-fashioned mindset is great for younger people. They say, don't park your reason at the door because of that in-love feeling. They encourage people to do due diligence. Ask questions like, is he or she going to be a good provider? Can he or she marry money? Because marriage isn't just a love relationship. It's a lifelong economic relationship. Mm-hmm. Ask your friends and relatives. One of their strongest rules is if nobody likes your partner, ask yourself why. So there are those kinds of concrete things they argue. And they also have tips like they really want young people to do a challenging experience, be it camping, Habitat for Humanity, one person joked, painting a room together. The whole idea, though, is to choose carefully and get to know the person well in addition to just being in love. I could either stop there or touch on your second question.
Well, touch on it, and then we'll go to some phone calls about the perfectionism.
They have a great antidote for perfectionism, and there were so many surprising things in what they had to say, and this was one. The one thing they want young people to know, and very few young people standing at the altar or getting engaged have this in mind, but they want young people to know that marriage is hard. It's tough. It takes spirit and drive and resilience. And what I took from these 700 interviews from long married people is the idea of marriage as a discipline, like learning a martial art or playing a musical instrument. It's nothing that you ever perfect, and that's why your point is so good. It's something, rather, that you continually work at, continually get better at, and where you defer some short-term gains for long-term outcomes, like being together for life. So you're right. They abandon the idea of perfection to one of continually trying to make things better on a day-to-day basis. And that was very enlightening for me.
I've had guests on who've studied other cultures, and they've found that sometimes arranged marriages are much happier than unarranged marriages.
You know, I had a number of people in the study, because I looked also specifically for Asian and Indian elders, where that is much more common. And it is true that everybody who was in an arranged marriage really said it worked well. And their argument was that the older people in the family did a lot of the vetting. They really looked for this kind of similarity and appropriateness. Now, I will say that every person I talked to in an arranged marriage said that the choice was ultimately theirs, and so they weren't completely forced into it. But often they were grateful for parents or aunties, as some of the Chinese folks called the folks who did this. They were actually somewhat grateful for it. So I'm not advocating it, but I will have to say that people who look back on a long marriage that was arranged are generally pretty positive.
All right, well.
And let's go to some happy cappers on the on the phones. This is Jeffrey, Boynton Beach. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
So, I've been in a relationship for about 2 years, and I'm perfectly happy. I act as if married, and my partner acts as if married, which means that I piss her off and she pisses me off, and that's just a natural way of it going, and there is no perfection, and I agree. But the response that I receive when she's in pique, P-I-Q-U-E, is often passive aggressiveness, doing the little things just to leave a trail of, here, you annoyed me, here, let me annoy you. How do you deal with that?
Okay.
You know, I can tell you, but what I like to say to people is that I may not know that much about marriage, but I know an awful lot of wise people who do. And I can tell you that the way that long married elders would answer a question like that, they spend a lot of time in our discussions and in the book talking about conflicts and how you relieve them. Now, I don't know that definitely this is going to be so profound. They argue, obviously, that talking these things out, and many of them said talk, and then keep talking. So that the idea is not to let arguments or disagreements go on over days and not to hold grudges, but to actually talk them out and try to resolve them. The other thing they argue for a negative pattern, but this is the view from 90 looking back, is to let time pass, you know, is to sort of let these things go by and see if time increasingly improves them. A final thing that the elders said for an ongoing situation like that was extremely surprising to me. But virtually 100% of the people wished for a persistent conflict problem that they had gotten help, even early in a relationship.
You mean professional help?
Even though they
help?
Weren't part of, yes, like go to a counselor.
Okay.
And I was stunned at how many of them felt that if there's a persistent issue, it's really worth going and seeing a counselor about it. So I think that's some response they would give.
Okay.
Most men do not want to see marriage counselors. Yeah. Is that correct?
It's men are much more reluctant than women. But let me tell you, this was one of the most surprising things. These are folks who are not part of our psychotherapeutic culture. And everybody who was really in trouble, who sought counseling, had incredibly benefited from it, and people who didn't wish they had. And they have kind of an iron law that they gave me. That's if your partner wants to go into counseling, you pretty much have to say yes. You know, even if you're a tough-talking or a non-talking man. And the reason why that's important, Richard, is that less than about a fifth of couples actually seek counseling before they break up. So it's very important advice, I think.
All right. Do you want a phone call or an email, Joe?
Let's go for a... Well, take your email.
Okay. I'm 31 years old. This is Daniel. Unmarried, straight male, but have been in a quite a long and stable relationship for 12 years. I've been engaged for 5 years. No plans for marriage. Reasons why we don't care to be married is that we do not see the importance of it, and the cost of some of these weddings are outrageous. I film them professionally and find that couples are spending upwards of $40,000 to $100,000. I find these may be some of the reasons why the younger generations aren't getting married like before. What do you think of that?
You know, I think he's absolutely right, and the older folks who I interviewed would absolutely agree that marriage isn't necessarily for everybody. And I talk to a lot of couples in long-term committed relationships who feel they are as if married. So they would agree that there certainly should be no pressure to get married in that sense. But there's one thing which is important. It's why I think this book is so relevant. If you look at surveys of young people, of people in their 20s and 30s, their desire to get married and their hopes for it haven't changed much at all in 100 years. Almost everybody in their 20s and 30s plans to get married. Almost all of them hope to stay married for life. And perhaps surprisingly, almost everyone wants to be faithful to one person if they're married. So even though I agree with the emailer, he's in a bit of a minority. You know, the dream of getting married and staying married is still a powerful cultural norm among young people today.
Okay.
And before our break, we'll take another call. We've got Mario in Miami. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I am a counselor in training, so this information is very much appreciated. And put it into context in the future. My question pertains a phenomenon that I became aware about a couple of years ago of the reunion of couples that fell madly in love in their teenage years, they were high school sweethearts, and for some circumstances like war or family mobility, they separated, and they end up reuniting later in life and forming excellent relationships. So I wonder if the research has any insights pertaining to that phenomenon.
Okay. That's an excellent question. And first of all, anecdotally, I saw it an extraordinary amount in these studies that we did of people who had reconnected with someone after 20, 30, 40, or 50 years. There might even be a high school reunion phenomenon in which people go back and find someone. But I also had a surprising number of couples, not a huge amount, but enough to remember, who had gotten divorced and then remarried decades later after rediscovering one another. So there are no studies of that particular phenomenon that I'm aware of, but it's one I think that I would like to do, and I hope that other colleagues will. I will say there was an overall argument from all of those people who'd had those kinds of experience of not giving up on finding love, of not giving up, of being perpetually hopeful if you're looking for a relationship. It was astonishing how many people had either found someone in their 70s and 80s or had refound someone, as the caller suggests. How widespread it is quantitatively, we don't know, but certainly anecdotally, it seems to happen very frequently.
It's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break. We're speaking with Dr. Carl Pillemer about his book, 30 Lessons for Loving. If you're waiting on the phone, we have some calls, so please just be patient and we'll get to you.
Thanks to online producer and today's technical director, Paul Leary, for adding that little ditty. If you'd like to join in, we have a few lines open. They're filling fast. 1-800-743-9576. You may prefer to email, and Bonnie will have that, radio@wlrn.org. radio@wlrn.org. Next caller. We've only had men so far.
Okay.
So we
Let's
have
go to a woman.
Alyssa in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Hi there. I live in a 30-year-old, 55-plus building, so many of my neighbors are 85-plus. I respect the couples who've been together for 60-plus years. We also have lots of elderly widows who give me advice, whether I solicit it or not. They know that I have a very happy marriage, and they see it all the time. I'm two generations younger than them, and I find that very often the advice, especially from the older women, it just doesn't translate to me. I find that they think I should give in to my husband and just think I'm superior over him because I'm just giving in, and I do know he's wrong, but I give in, and I have to dress up and look beautiful on the weekends for him. It's advice that doesn't translate to someone my age, in my 40s, who's financially sufficient. I can live on my own. I'm not indebted to my husband. Did you find any research in your research that some of the young people just thought that the older people's advice was just not timely?
Absolutely, and that is an incredibly good question, because it really cuts to the core of doing these kind of studies of older people's advice or younger people. And here would be my answer. In some cases, their advice is really different. At the highest level, so to speak, or at the most general level, I think a lot of it is extremely relevant and good for young people to think about, because it's less about the kind of current historical situation like you're describing. But there is absolutely no question that, for example, they argue that people should, you know, kind of stay in good shape and try to look attractive for their spouses and that kind of thing. What I argued in this book, And in presenting what they told me was that it's still worthwhile for younger people to hear what they have to say, because at least gets them thinking. It gets them pondering this different worldview, even though it might seem a bit old-fashioned. So I would say that would... So the answer is yes, that their view may be different. I think in large part it's relevant, but in some cases it may seem old-fashioned and irrelevant.
We have... Well, I want to ask you this, Doctor. Did the elders have tips for keeping romance alive even after you had one couple that had been married for 76 years? Was there a little secret to keeping romance alive?
I felt that they would be the best sources of asking, how do you keep the spark alive in a relationship for 50, 60, or 70 years, which is of concern for all of us, and for young people starting out, seems almost incomprehensible. And for those people who did it, they had a whole series of pieces of advice, and let me just give you one which I think cuts to the core of what they're saying. Their view is that to keep a marriage interesting, big ticket items aren't really the key. And their advice is to focus on small things and small and positive things. And really that ties into research, that a marriage is really made up of hundreds or thousands of tiny micro interactions throughout the course of the day. So if someone interrupts you while you're reading the paper, how do you respond? Do you pay compliments? Do you do small surprises? People talked very often about unexpectedly doing the other person's chore. So say the dog is scratching at your door on a cold wintry morning, at least up here, and it's your turn to take him out, and your partner says, no, I'll just do it. Those kinds of this habit of small positive things is what kept the most vibrant relationships alive, and that actually is a finding that's very backed up by research, that it's not these major events, but it's an attitude of positiveness, cheerfulness, even politeness in a relationship goes wonders. And the nice thing about that is that's something that most couples can try. It's not a rocket science thing to introduce into your relationship.
What about couples who are married 50, 60, 65 years and bicker constantly? Underneath it all, are they enjoying it?
You know, there have been the answer is yes and no. There have been a number of major studies looking at different types of long marriages, and the kind you've described actually has a name. People call it conflict habituated. So it's a stable marriage, it's lasted for years, and yet the people just seem to bicker all the time.
Was it in conflict what?
Conflict habituated.
Conflict habituated marriages. and all of us have seen it, right? I think, though, it's hard to know. Those marriages certainly are stable, and I talked to elders who were in stable but unhappy marriages. I didn't focus only on people in wonderful relationships. I also talked to some people in relationships like that. In general, the folks who were happy but had that kind of bickering said, we have a fight, 10 times a day, but we don't carry it over. What's really damaging, both from the standpoint of the elders and from some recent research, is what people might refer to as contempt, as an argument or a fight that becomes personally injurious and contemptuous and devalues the other person. Small little bickering throughout the day is not usually such a danger sign, as are these extraordinarily hurtful and almost contemptuous remarks. And I think, that most people know those when they see them. But that certainly exists. And we've all seen the couples who fight and yet seem to love one another.
So it's the old don't go to bed angry, or as Joan Rivers says, no, you shouldn't, stay up and fight all night.
that's pretty close to what most people said. If you... If I asked your listeners to do an experiment and go find a person age 75 or older and ask them for their three pieces of advice, don't go to bed angry is sure to be in there. And they mean something very special by that, and that is just not to carry anger over for days. It isn't literally going to bed, but it's put an argument to bed eventually and clear things up, and don't hold grudges over time. So it was a cliche, but I found it had some meaning behind it.
And we have Jason and Davey. Jason, you're up. Hi.
Hi, Joe. Hi, Bonnie. Thank you very much for taking my call. Kind of in maybe not what's a traditional relationship. My wife is 66. I'm 43. We've been in a relationship for over 20 years, been married for three. And does your guest have any comment or anything where there are the age differences in the relationships where they're happier? Because I married my best friend, and every day it gets better and better.
Well, first of all, you've done absolutely the right thing as a man. The biggest problem, or one of the biggest problems with marriage, is that men tend to marry women who are much younger than they are, and men die earlier, thus leaving women, you know, for a decade or more of widowhood. So, almost completely seriously, I say, good move, and that's what people should do. You know, I looked at age discrepancies in this sample, and I would absolutely agree that these were often profoundly happy relationships, that people found being with someone who was older, who was more stable, more advanced along a life's course was outstandingly good. So that I think there's a lot of positive aspects of that. The only problem with the age discrepancy is really falls in terms of caregiving. So often the younger person becomes a caregiver much earlier than they would expect because people do get ill as they get old. And differences in life stage, where let's say a young woman is still working and her husband is retired and wants her to stop working. So as long as people can get through those kinds of structural issues, there are a lot of positives about that kind of age discrepancy. I think the caller's right.
All right. Thanks for calling, Jason. One more short break on Topical Current, speaking with Dr. Carl Pillemer about his book, 30 Lessons for Loving. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with gerontologist Dr. Carl Pillemer. We're talking about the book he's written, which relates to a long study of over 700 elderly people who had been married. The book is called Lessons for Loving, Advice from the Wisest Americans on Love, Relationships, and Marriage. And we'll have a link to that at our Topical Currents Facebook page, as well as WLRN.org.
It's 30 Lessons for Loving.
30 Lessons. What did I say?
You just said Lessons for Loving. Okay, are there 30?
It was close enough. Yeah.
Close enough. Okay, Martin says, this is a great email. Some people say that you have to learn to love yourself first before you try looking for someone. That in some way, the love you desire will not come from another, but that you can share a life of love when you are not in neediness of it. What, if anything, did you learn about this? Did the wise individuals you met with give any indication of this?
He could imagine these 700 people in a room applauding that particular statement.
Uh-huh.
That really hits on a number of their points. One is, and this was a real surprise for members of this generation, they argue people should get married later. And that's an indication of knowing yourself and knowing what you need and knowing what you want out of a relationship. Many of them got married at 18, 19, 20, even 17, and virtually to a person. They said, even though my marriage turned out well, I wish I had waited. And it's precisely that sense of self-knowledge, of self-direction, and of making a good choice when you're a little bit older. And I want to tell listeners, this, by the way, is exactly what research shows, that anybody who waits until, say, over age 27, after they've got their life a little more established and know themselves better, is dramatically more likely to have a long-term stable marriage. So I think that's a critically important point, and I'm glad the listener raised it.
Yeah, it was a great point. Thanks, Martin.
And we move along to Stephen in Miami. Stephen, you're up.
Hi there.
Hi.
I've been married 45 years. We dated 5 years before we got married. We were in 10th grade when we started dating. And at that time, my father-in-law, who's now deceased, used to tell my wife and her brother, whenever they argued, he would say, fight nice. And what that has come to mean for my wife and myself is that when you do get in an argument or disagreement or whatever, don't make it personal. don't attack the person that you supposedly are in love with, because every time you attack that person on a personal level, it does a little bit of damage to your relationship. And if constantly done, it will eventually blow up and damage your relationship. Mm. And we've kind of lived by that. And in all honesty, we haven't had an argument or a fight in maybe the past 30 years.
Good point. Doctor?
I think that's absolutely right. And I wish I'd had, the listener in my study. That would have been, that's very, very consistent. No,
and also, I'd like to add, in terms of children, or this isn't the study, my children never fight. I have three adult children. They never do fight with each other. And when they were young, fighting among them was prohibited. We did not allow them to fight. If they had an argument, then our goal wasn't to say, whose fault is it? What happened? We would say, both of you go to your room until you learn how to deal with each other appropriately.
Mm. Well, I'm going to bet, too, and this is one of the very important points of the elders, that you modeled getting along with each other well. And that's one of the arguments they make, is that the reason why arguing respectfully, and it's certain that you're going to argue, but having it not cut to the jugular is so critical, because your children are going to model their future relationships on you. The elders point out something which I think that the caller was implying. Namely, that in marriage, we get comfortable, and so comfortable that we often are tactless and hurtful, that we don't use the same kinds of manners that we would use in other situations. But also, our knowledge of the person is so in-depth that it's much more easy to wound them. It's like shooting fish in a barrel, really, because you know your partner so well.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for them, is where the concept of respect comes in. That by being respectful, that protects you against your ability to really, really wound the other person. And I think that that's consonant with what the caller was suggesting.
We have an emailer, and we haven't touched on this. What advice would you have for a wife of a man who does not acknowledge that there's a problem, refuses to go to counseling? At what point do you recommend separation? Or is there any resolution in separating, or is divorce inevitable?
So I want to remind folks, I am a social scientist and not a trained counselor.
Right.
And the one thing that the elders would uniformly recommend, again, is before you get out, get help. And if the person, because really a marriage counseling, they found, worked wonders, or individual counseling, if your partner won't go with you. So that's really critical. They would argue that probably a relationship like this could improve with outside help, and they really mean it. They also do acknowledge, though, that sometimes a marriage simply can't go on forever. And if it's so unfulfilling and there have been repeated attempts made, there are some who finally did get out. Unfortunately, there really is no golden rule or magic key to know when that moment is, except the elders would tell you in cases like violence or real abuse. That pretty much is an individual decision. However, they would argue, don't make that decision alone. It's just too complicated for a person to do on their own and to get help to do it.
Did any of your respondents in the survey come from marriages which was, say the society girl who marries the blue-collar boy, or...?
There were a surprising amount, of course, but, you know, the interesting thing about marriage is that happens a lot less in general than we think it is. Basically, it's got another fancy term, assortative mating, which means that most of us run into potential mates who are pretty much like us. And so there is a tendency to marry somebody who's more or less in your social stratum. Now, this is, of course, changing in our very mobile and diverse society. But there is some of that. I would come back to the fundamental point that the elders made. They say, don't avoid that kind of a marriage, say, totally different socioeconomic strata, if you're deeply in love. But if you're very different going into it, in background, family, just be aware that there are probably going to be some issues, and you ought to be prepared for them. That the odds of difficulties are greater if your backgrounds and orientations are very different. Don't give up on getting married, but keep it in mind and be prepared for it, I think would be their message.
Of your 30 lessons, two questions. Which one do you consider to be the most important of the 30 lessons in your book, and which surprised you the most?
You know, that's always a hard one. There were, because many of them were surprising. I would say, if I had to vote for one, and this is maybe, I shouldn't have these as a gerontologist, but I do have my own stereotypes, was how relatively positive these long-married elders were about sex and intimacy. And there's no question that younger people have this ingrained view of the sexless older years. If they see a movie in which older people are in a sexual situation, they see it as yucky. And so they can't get their minds around it, and they worry about it a lot. Virtually every one of the oldest Americans I talked to said, stop worrying about it. Mm. It's really pretty good. And for some people, their intimate relationship actually got better after all the stresses of having children and work, etc. And, you know, the major barrier for older people, I learned from looking at the research, to having a good sexual relationship is lack of a partner. Folks who are in relationships are really doing pretty well, and they find that the idea of intimacy really expands. So I would say, you know, that's one of the key things that, you know, that really surprised me. I'd say in terms of what I think is the one lesson they would like to convey most to young people is that a long and happy marriage is possible. It actually is possible, and we touched on this earlier, so I won't go into too long, but don't be overly pessimistic about a happy marriage lasting for life. And if you get there, talking to these people, it's transcendental. It's the most important experience of their lives. And if you sit with somebody who's been married for 70 years, you can really see it. So I think, you know, that may be the most important lesson in the book, is this gloom and doom about marriage, in their view, isn't really necessary because they've made it happen and it was a terrific life journey.
We just have a minute, Doctor, but quickly, do women seek their father and do men seek their mothers?
He's not a psychiatrist. He's a sociologist.
You know, can I say, though, that's something which I would have thought would have come up. People never said that, surprisingly. Mm. The one thing which they did say, though, is look at your partner's family. This sounds old-fashioned, but they said how your partner relates to his or her family is a reasonable indication. So it wasn't just fathers and mothers. I'll make that my next study.
Okay,
you see the mother and you say, that's going to be Barbara in 30
years. I married somebody who was totally unlike my mother, and I've been married for 36 years, so I would be the exception.
Okay, I was actually going to ask you about that if it wasn't too personal. Good to know.
No, I married my high school sweetheart.
Oh, that's great. Dr. Carl Pillemer is a professor of human development at Cornell University and a prolific author, an internationally renowned gerontologist, and the founder and director of the Cornell Institute for Translational.
Translating research into things that people can use.
Okay, translational research on aging. His Twitter is at Carl Pillemer, P-I-L-L-E-M-E-R. And I guess the website is marriagelegacy.org?
Yep, that's the best one. And folks can add their own lessons for loving there, too. And we print and we publish them. So if folks would like to contribute, who didn't get to the phones, we're always happy to hear their ideas.
Okay, the name of the book is 30 Lessons for Loving, Advice from the Wisest Americans on Love, Relationships, and Marriage. Thanks so much, Dr. Pillemer.
Oh, I really appreciate it. Great talking with you and with your listeners.
Thank you.
And thus our hour ends. We hope you enjoyed the conversation. Apologies to those we couldn't get on the air. Richard Ives is our producer. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Michael Stock took our calls. It's easy to find free audio archives of this program on our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, photos, and discussion at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program revels in Miami of the past and the present, royal castles, funfair, Verdine's Christmases, and the like. We'll visit with the author of Discovering Vintage Miami. Also, Linda Gastenheimer's annual Super Bowl program. We've got a Super Bowl watching menu. Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.